So imagine realizing that the water you've been drinking for like 10 days straight was poisoned.
Right.
And you only find out because the city finally got around to checking the reservoir.
It's a terrifying thought.
Yeah, it really is. And on Monday, April 13, 2026, which is the massive news day we're covering for you today, OpenAI, literally one of the most secured tech companies on Earth, realized they had been, well, drinking poisoned code.
Yeah, it's honestly a sobering realization for the entire industry. I mean, today's source material paints this really vivid picture of a world moving in two completely opposite directions at the exact same time.
Exactly. Welcome to today's deep dive, everyone. We are looking at a day that feels almost like a split-screen movie.
Oh, for sure.
On one side of the screen, you have this incredible human innovation just running at a crazy pace. Hardware engineers are building these pocket-sized supercomputers that rival actual professional workstations.
Right, pushing the boundaries of physics.
Yeah. But then on the other side of that screen, you have these invisible, highly orchestrated digital bank heists just happening in the shadows.
It's quite the contrast.
It really is. So our mission for this deep dive is to unpack how intertwined our physical devices and our digital vulnerabilities have become. We want to give you the aha insights to navigate this landscape without just, feeling totally overwhelmed.
And really, the thread connecting all of these events isn't just the technology itself, it's trust,
Crust, yeah.
right? Because we're constantly evaluating the trust we place in the software supply chains that run our apps, the trust we give to brick and mortar businesses holding our physical data, and even the trust we put in the actual silicon we carry in our pockets.
Okay, let's unpack this because we really have to start with that poisoned water reservoir analogy at OpenAI.
Right.
We usually picture a corporate hack as like someone trying to break down the front door with brute force, but this was a highly complex supply chain attack.
Yeah, they didn't break the door down at all.
No, they just walked in through the back door holding a delivery box that OpenAI's automated systems happily accepted.
And what's wild is that the Google Threat Intelligence Group attributed this specific attack to UNC 20F69.
Right, the North Korean group.
Exactly, a financially motivated hacker group affiliated with North Korea. And they didn't even attempt to attack OpenAI servers directly. I mean, that would just be way too
Yeah,
difficult.
friction.
Right. So instead, on March 31st, 2026, they compromised the developer account of Jason Sayman,
And for those who don't know, Jason is the main maintainer of a JavaScript library called Axios.
which is everywhere.
Literally everywhere. Axios is like the digital plumbing routing data for thousands of applications. I mean, it has over 100 million weekly downloads. It's ubiquitous. If you use the internet, you are interacting with code that relies on Axios.
Precisely. So by compromising Jason's account, UNC Winner 69 was able to publish two malicious versions of Axio.
Versions 1.7.5 and 1.7.6, right?
Yeah, those exact ones. And they put them on NPM, which is the central registry where developers go to download JavaScript tools.
Right.
Those updates contain code specifically designed to exfiltrate sensitive environment variables and credentials.
And the way it traveled up the chain into OpenAI is just fascinating.
It's all automated.
Exactly. OpenAI uses GitHub Actions to automate their software builds. So while their automated workflow was busy signing legitimate applications for macOS, the workflow just reached out to NPM, requested Axios, and pulled in that malicious payload completely automatically.
And the dwell time is really what makes this so critical.
Yeah, talk about that gap.
Well, the malicious code was published on March 31st, but OpenAI didn't discover the compromise and announce the revocation of their Mako signing certificates until April 10th.
Wow.
Yeah, that is a 10-day gap where a highly privileged automated environment was just executing poisoned code.
OpenAI did confirm that no end user data was compromised, right?
Correct, yeah. But I mean, the sheer fact that the code made it inside their walls is the real story here.
Right. I mean, if a company as incredibly resourced as OpenAI can accidentally drink the poison water, what hope do regular developers have?
It's a very fair question.
We are talking about a dependency tree where one compromised developer can infect a massive chunk of the modern web literally overnight.
What's fascinating here is the evolution of the threat landscape. North Korean state-sponsored actors are clearly shifting away from those opportunistic smash-and-grab operations.
The old style of hacking.
Right, exactly. They are moving toward industrial-scale, highly targeted operations. They understand that modern software development relies on this massive tower of open source dependencies.
You don't hack the target.
Exactly. You hack the foundation the target relies on.
Okay, so how does a development team actually defend against this? Because you can't manually read every line of code in an update for a library that has 100 million downloads. That's impossible.
No, you can't. So you have to build a layered cryptographic defense. First, the ecosystem is enforcing two-factor authentication for maintainers on NPM and GitHub.
Which stops the initial account takeover, like what happened to Jason.
Right. But defensively, developers themselves must use lock files, like package-lock.json.
Wait, let's explain the mechanism there, because it's not just a basic text list of programs to download, is it?
No, not at all. A lock file ties a specific dependency to a cryptographic hash.
Okay.
So when you tell your system to download Axios, the lock file ensures it doesn't just grab the newest version, which, you know, might be malicious.
Right.
It downloads the exact version you've previously vetted and then computes a mathematical hash of that file.
If it doesn't match.
If the hash doesn't perfectly match the lock file, the system flat out refuses to install it.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. And if you combine that with automated vulnerability scanners like Dependabot or SNCC, you create this rigid filter that prevents unauthorized code from sneaking in.
Okay. But all of that sophisticated cryptographic defense only really matters for tech companies building software. Let's pivot and look at the physical world for a second. Because physical brick-and-mortar businesses are quickly becoming the new soft underbelly of the digital economy.
Oh, absolutely.
We secure our tech giants like Fort Knox, but on the exact same day, Basic Fit, which is Europe's largest gym chain, announced a highly invasive data breach.
Yeah, affecting 1 million of their members.
1 million people. You go to the gym to protect your physical health, but who is protecting your financial health while you're on the treadmill?
It's a great point, and the scale of this is just massive. Out of their 5 million total members, about 20% were compromised across 6 different countries.
With the Netherlands and Belgium taking the absolute brunt of it, right?
Yeah, the Netherlands had about 400,000 members exposed, which is like 40% of the victims, and Belgium had around 250,000. Germany, France, Spain, and Luxembourg were also hit.
And they managed to steal names, physical addresses, phone numbers, email addresses, and here is the kicker, IBANs.
International bank account numbers, yeah.
The company was quick to point out that passwords weren't compromised. But honestly, having your direct bank routing details exposed feels infinitely worse to me. Isn't it wild that a gym membership requires the same level of cybersecurity as an online bank?
It really is wild. And here's why it matters so much. This marks a paradigm shift. A gym membership now requires you to hand over the exact same highly sensitive financial routing data that you'd give to an actual financial institution.
Right.
Hackers have realized that every business, from local gyms to restaurants to retail stores, is now a data target. They often run legacy database software, yet they hold incredibly lucrative financial records.
Because with an IBAN out in the wild, criminals can just set up unauthorized direct debits.
Exactly.
And that completely shifts the burden of proof onto you, the consumer. Now you have to constantly monitor your bank statements and fight to reverse fraudulent charges.
Yeah. Basic Fit is covering the costs of data misuse and setting up emergency lines, which speaks to the immense financial liability these brick-and-mortar companies now face. But for the listener, the immediate threat isn't just a fraudulent gym charge. It is what the hackers do with a verified database of 1 million people's names, emails, and bank details.
Which perfectly explains our next source.
Right.
Because once they have that data, they monetize it using an entire underground economy. They take your gym data to fuel highly targeted phishing attacks.
Exactly.
But the good news from April 13th is that global law enforcement is actively dismantling the infrastructure, making this possible.
Yeah, we saw a major takedown. The FBI in Atlanta, working directly with the Indonesian police, dismantled an operation known as W3LL.
And this wasn't just a group of hackers manually sending emails.
No, W3LL was a highly sophisticated phishing-as-a-service kit, and they sold it to other criminals for just $500.
Here's where it gets really interesting. For $500, criminals basically get a fraud-in-a-box kit.
Yeah, it's wild. Between 2023 and 2024, the W3LL platform facilitated the sale of 25,000 compromised accounts.
Jeez.
They hit 17,000 global victims and attempted $20 million in fraud.
And they arrested the developer in Indonesia. Right, the guy going by GL.
They did. But the technology W3LL used is what really makes it so dangerous. It used what we call adversary-in-the-middle architecture.
Okay, To understand why adversary in the middle is so devastating, we have to look at how normal two-factor authentication works.
Right.
Normally, if someone steals your password, they still can't get in because they don't have the six-digit code sent to your phone.
Exactly. But W3LL bypasses that entirely.
I read this great analogy in our notes about this being like a digital wristband at a club.
It is the perfect way to visualize it. So the W3LL phishing page sits directly between you and the real website.
Like a middleman.
Right. You type your password into the fake site. It passes it to the real site. The real site asks for your 2FA code. You type that into the fake site. It passes it along again.
Just relaying everything.
Exactly. And once the real site is satisfied, it issues a session cookie, which is basically that VIP digital wristband that proves you are authenticated so you don't have to log in every time you click a new page.
And the fake site just steals the wristband.
Exactly. The hacker now has the session cookie. They can literally walk right past the bouncer, completely bypassing your password and your two-factor authentication.
But the sheer scale of W3LL proves that cybercrime isn't just lone wolves anymore. This is now a scalable corporate model.
Oh, absolutely. If we connect this to the bigger picture, cybercrime is a corporate industry with clear pricing models now.
Right. I mean, for $500, criminals are buying a subscription to a platform that includes patch notes, customer service, and enterprise-grade tools to steal session cookies.
It's terrifying.
But wait, if the fake site is just passing the information along like a middleman, how can everyday users possibly defend against cookie-stealing tech? I know hardware keys are the standard recommendation, but why wouldn't the fake site just pass the hardware keys code along too? How does a piece of plastic know it's being lied to?
That is the crucial difference. A hardware key, like a YubiKey using the FIDO2 standard, doesn't just generate a generic six-digit code.
Okay.
It uses something called cryptographic origin binding.
Meaning it checks the actual URL.
Exactly. When the website asks for proof of identity, the hardware key mathematically signs the specific URL of the site requesting the authentication.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So if you are on a W3LL phishing site, let's say it's spelled slightly wrong, like banksecurity-update.com instead of your actual bank stopple, the hardware key mathematically binds the authentication to that fake URL.
Right.
When the middleman passes that data to the real bank, the real bank server looks at the cryptographic signature, sees that it was signed for a different URL, and instantly rejects it. The middleman gets absolutely nothing.
That is brilliant. It removes human error from the equation entirely.
It really does.
And law enforcement didn't stop there. We also saw the results of Operation Atlantic, which was a massive joint strike by the UK's National Crime Agency, the US Secret Service, and Canadian authorities.
Yeah, and they targeted a completely different ecosystem. Approval phishing in the crypto space. Approval phishing abuses the fundamental way smart contracts work on the blockchain. And the numbers here are staggering. Authorities identified over 20,000 victims across 30 countries.
And the money involved?
Huge. They froze $12 million, which is about 27% of the total. And they're actively tracing another $33 million. So we're talking about a $45 million operation.
How does approval phishing actually differ from just someone stealing your seed phrase?
Well, when you interact with a decentralized application, you often have to sign an approval transaction.
Right.
That gives a smart contract permission to spend a specific amount of a certain token from your wallet. It is an intended necessary function of the blockchain.
But criminals are setting up fake investment sites or fake token airdrops to abuse that.
Yes. When you click to claim an airdrop on a malicious site, you think you are just signing a receipt.
Right.
But what you are actually signing is an approval transaction granting the hacker's smart contract an infinite allowance to withdraw your tokens. You are essentially handing them a blank check digitally signed by your own wallet.
Which is why security tools like Revoke.cash were so critical, allowing you to audit your wallet and revoke those blank checks.
Correct. For the listener, never sign a transaction you don't fully understand and always maintain strict separation between the active wallet you use for daily transactions and a cold offline hardware wallet where the bulk of your funds sit securely.
Absolutely. So all these sophisticated automated phishing kits and crypto drainers rely on immense processing power and constant connectivity.
Yeah.
The hackers are relentlessly upgrading their arsenals, which forces us to look at the other side of this arms race, the actual physical devices in our pockets.
Right. Hardware engineers aren't just sitting still while software developers fight these battles.
Exactly. While law enforcement defends our digital borders, hardware engineers are aggressively pushing the physical boundaries of the very devices we are trying to secure. Let's look at the hardware leaps from April 13th, starting with the Huawei Pura X Max.
Yeah, the Pura X Max is slated for launch on April 20, 2026, initially in China and then globally. And the defining feature here is the form factor.
It's different.
Very. Huawei is bringing the world's first wide-format foldable phone to market.
They are beating both Samsung with their rumored Galaxy Z Fold 8 wide and Apple's long-rumored foldable.
Yeah, up until now, foldable phones have almost universally used a book-style design.
Right. When closed, they are tall and narrow, kind of like a TV remote control.
Exactly. But Huawei is introducing a 7.69-inch inner screen with a wide aspect ratio paired with a 5.5-inch outer screen.
Why does the aspect ratio matter so much for the actual utility of the device?
Because a tall and narrow screen fundamentally limits productivity. A wider aspect ratio transforms the device when opened. Instead of just a larger phone interface, it immediately functions like a landscape tablet.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, you can comfortably run two complex applications side by side without squishing the user interface. It fundamentally changes how you consume media and manage workflows. And honestly, launching this first proves Huawei remains an absolute mobile powerhouse, fully capable of driving global hardware trends despite complex international sanctions.
It's impressive. And then we have the leaks regarding the Vivo X Fold 6, releasing in mid-2026, like June or July.
Oh, yeah. The specs on this device push the boundaries of what is physically possible.
They really do. They're packing in a 200-megapixel main camera.
Probably the sensor from the X300 series.
Right. Which is incredibly difficult given the space constraints of a folding chassis. But the real story is the battery. Leaks suggest a record-breaking capacity of roughly 7,000 milliamp hours.
To contextualize that for you listening, standard foldables on the market have hovered around 4,400 milliamp hours for years.
Like the Galaxy Z Fold 6.
Exactly. So Vivo is introducing roughly 60% more battery capacity alongside 100-watt plus fast charging and the brand new Snapdragon 8 Gen 5 processor.
Fitting a 7,000 milliamp hour battery into a foldable chassis. I mean, it's like trying to fit a V8 engine into a compact car.
It really is.
Or like taking a massive, ultra-thick winter sleeping bag and vacuum sealing it down to the size of a thin paperback book.
Yeah.
You aren't losing the bag. You are just fundamentally changing how the materials pack together. But how are they achieving this density without making the phone like an inch thick?
It comes down to a major breakthrough in material science. Silicon carbon battery technology.
Okay, break that down for us.
Well, traditional lithium-ion batteries rely on graphite anodes to hold lithium ions. But silicon can bond with vastly more lithium ions than graphite can. It's like replacing a flat parking lot where every car needs a massive amount of space with an automated multi-level parking garage.
But didn't silicon historically have a major flaw where it would expand and degrade the battery?
It did, yeah. Silicon expands up to 300% when it absorbs lithium.
Wow.
Which would literally shatter the internal structure of the battery after just a few charge cycles.
So what changed?
The breakthrough is creating a silicon carbon composite matrix that stabilizes the silicon, preventing that expansion while maintaining the incredible energy density. You get a massive power reserve stored in the exact same physical volume.
The battery chemistry is incredible, but I have to push back on the physical ergonomics of this whole wide format trend.
Okay, let's hear it.
Yes. A wider screen is amazing for running two apps side by side or watching a movie. But when the device is closed, a wider, substantially heavier foldable seems like it would be a total nightmare to use securely with one hand while walking down the street holding a coffee.
I agree. It is a significant compromise. The physics of the device demand trade-offs. A wider chassis makes it fundamentally harder to grip securely with one hand, which impacts pocketability.
Right.
Furthermore, software developers are going to have to entirely redesign and optimize their applications for this new aspect ratio to prevent that awkward letterboxing.
Yeah, that's a huge lift for developers.
It is. And naturally, packing commercialized silicon carbon batteries, 200 megapixel sensors, and massive folding displays will definitely command a much higher ultra premium price tag.
So what does this all mean? When you step back and look at the whole picture of April 13, 2026, we see an ecosystem defined by extreme contrasts.
Definitely.
We are witnessing highly sophisticated supply chain attacks injecting poisoned code into our most trusted tech giants. We are seeing legacy brick-and-mortar businesses exposing millions of bank records. And we are watching organized cybercrime operate with, like, subscription-tier business models.
Right.
But at the exact same time, human innovation is relentlessly pushing forward, giving us materials, science breakthroughs, and portable supercomputers that rival desktop workstations.
The duality of the modern tech landscape is just inescapable at this point.
It really is. So the core takeaway for you listening is this. Enjoy the incredible tech advancements. Appreciate the science that allows a 7,000 milliamp hour battery to exist in your pocket, but you must treat your personal security as a daily, non-negotiable habit. Use hardware security keys to bind your authentication, leverage tools to audit your digital wallets, and aggressively monitor your financial footprint. You are the final, most important line of defense in this ecosystem.
And I will leave you with this final provocative thought to mull over.
Okay.
If our foldable devices are now housing 7,000 milliamp hour batteries, desktop tier processors, and massive widescreens capable of running complex local AI models, they are no longer just phones.
No, they're not.
They are our primary localized command centers. This raises a really critical question for the future. As these physical devices become exponentially more complex and capable of processing sensitive data entirely on the device, will the next generation of supply chain attacks stop targeting open source software in the cloud and start targeting the physical silicon components of these hardware supercomputers before they ever even leave the manufacturing floor?
Oh, wow. A physical supply chain attack on the silicon itself. We were living in a split screen reality, and both sides of the screen are moving incredibly fast. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious, stay secure, and keep exploring. We'll catch you next time.